Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think this book had traveled such a journey that I could never expect it to have. I wrote it as a letter of love, and it became to be suspected as a political manifest, and it came back to be a literary work, back to into 23 languages, and it travels the world, and it has more and more readership extended, and having more and more people to, I mean, it's the acoustic of the heart that we're engaged with in this job of writing novels. It's not crying out loud in squares and changing the world, and it's bit by bit. It's I hope for this book to reach the impact that the books I love and the books that influenced me and gave me the food of thought, of that prolonged within my mind. I wish for the book to gain this achievement in the scale of one person. I leave it there. I know that it's such a huge mileage within time, within people's thinking, with perspectives. I consider it to be a huge step.
How did a love story between an Israeli woman and a Palestinian man pose a threat to Jewish identity? And how do issues of nationalism, religion and ethnicity impact on writers and artists from Israel and Palestine? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to cross borders, cultures and centuries and unpack the complex nature of time, intimacy and love with two inspiring and thought-provoking writers. One an Englishman, the other an Israeli. Writers of tremendous subtlety, sensitivity and beauty. Dorit Rabinian unpacks the tensions between the personal and the political, as teased out in her controversial bestseller, All the Rivers. And Matt Haig talks his latest book, How to Stop Time, published by Canongate. This is a show about fear and attraction, political censorship, and the transformative power of love and desire. But first, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full, because all the rivers return to the rivers. Believe me, it's the secret of tidal flows. It's the secret of wistfulness. The hypnotic words of Hebrew poet and activist Avot Yeshurun, which opens Dorit Rabinian's third novel, All the Rivers, published by Profile Books.
Hello, I'm Dorit Rabinian. I'm an author from Israel. I am from an Iranian descent. My family immigrated from Tehran, and I grew up in Kfar Saba, which is a small town in the north of Tel Aviv. And I wrote three novels. The From Persian Brides that I published at the age of 22 up until now, 22 years. 3 years ago, I published in Hebrew the book that just came out in English, All the Rivers. It tells the story of a Middle Eastern couple, a taboo relationship of a Israeli woman, Jewish Israeli woman, and a Muslim Palestinian man. They meet in New York, and they spend 6 months in the New York harsh winter where they explore one another in this intimate relationship. And it had gave me a lot of trouble, above of all the love, applauds, awards, and a very good sales. I get to be a center of a political scandal in Israel when the book was banned from schools, from high school curriculum. So I had to defend it, and I had so many Israelis who were supporting the book because they saw it to be a symbol for the threat of the freedom of speech in Israel nowadays under the Netanyahu governments that try to make Israel more clamped within itself, more fortified within just its own justifications. And my book had broke out to be a center of a great controversy because of the report written by the Ministry of Education, the ministerial committee, that its arguments stated this book to be, quote, a threat to the Jewish identity of the young readers, that they might find it to be encouraging to have intimate relationship between Jews and non-Jews, and eventually lead to assimilation of the Jewish identity within the Arab surrounding Middle East.
Doris, really well done on your talk today at the festival. It was very interesting, and the audience pitched up some very difficult questions back at you, and it was very curious to watch. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. Does all love, irrespective of political consciousness, challenge identities? Because you've got two people, two different people, falling in love, and it can create all types of complications, irrespective of what you politically think about the world or wherever your moral frame of reference comes from.
Such a wonderful question, because it's not necessarily that there should be an ethnic conflict between the two tribes that these two lovers come from in order to create this fear of assimilation. Every intimate involvement, having one identity washed with the colors of the other's identity, getting close and having this fear to have been devoured by the one you're being loved. We have this recall for ourselves being babies, being young kids, and having the mother's identity and ours identity to live in symbiotic closeness. And we know it took us a lifetime to separate and to individualize ourselves. And how much pleasure there is in this intimacy, in this symbiosis. But it's been recalled in romantic intimacy because of its dark side. It's not only sweet, but it also can be subsuming. It also can be
conquering.
It might be a threat to our identity being taken over by the identity of the ones we love. So it's always a struggle to keep a certain parts of yourself separate, independent, and it's always goes through the fear of losing yourself beyond recognition in the one that is most dear and most fundamentally known to you.
You must have been pretty surprised by the Ministry of Education's ban on your book in schools.
Was I surprised? I was overwhelmed because of being so formulated by the democratic portrait of Israel's identity, by the Israeli democratic values of liberalism, of freedom of speech. I could never imagine, this is the very first time that ever such thing as banning a book from high school curriculum happens in Israel. You can be saying sarcastically that Israel is becoming more like the neighboring countries that she wants to different itself from, because our neighbors do ban books. But it's the very first time ever happened to Israel that considers itself to be so modern and liberal, but yet the Ministry of Education is held by a right-wing religious minister who has no limits for his ambitions to conquer the prime ministry. So he had taken me as a target of hatred and made me to be, as an artist, a symbol of a threat to the young readers being influenced by these ideas of learning the other, exploring the other, getting close to the other, which the Ministry of Education, part of the Israeli government, is making such an effort to isolate and to nationalize the young readers ever since the assassination of Rabin in 1995, the prime minister who was preceding a peace process and we're giving these the my generation so much hope. This generation that my book was prevented from to read, they never tasted the promise of peace, of a near hope to be fulfilled. They are so swept with everything that is being given by this regime, everything that is being shadowed by this regime. So much of their aspiration for a change is being demolished. They've been raised and growing in a different Israel than I did.
What's interesting is that you wrote this book with no political agenda, that you were coming at it as an artistic enterprise and that you're reimagining, creatively reimagining a very close friend of yours that you knew, a Palestinian boy that you knew in New York. So it's very bittersweet, isn't it?
The success, you mean? You know, the work itself was liberating. The work itself means the craft. The 6 years of writing that I spent reinventing myself, reinventing Hassan Houani, the Palestinian artist I knew very closely and very... I dedicate the book to him. I addressed my writing to him. I felt his presence in my study when I was writing this book. I wasn't alone. I felt he was helping me. He was not only inspiring me by our dialogue, the conversation was renewed. I had to carry out his memory. I had to save him. I had to reach out and continue from where we stopped. So his life wasn't resurrected, but his literary figure was turned fiction to be a space where we were unified, reunited. And it was crucial that his memory was brought back to life with my Hebrew words. My Hebrew language that has caused him and his family so much travesties, my Israeli existence was coming under so many Palestinians' account. I felt like it was encouraging me to redeem him from this sack of nationalistic interest and exploitation of the multitude, and to personalize him, to particularizing him and myself with Hebrew words, with my tool, my equipment, my power to pull him back to reality as much as a fictional space of a file within a computer is reality. But once it had came out, so many people got to know him and his family are being, every time I have a new edition, a new translation, and I have 23 of them, I bring it for him, to them, and I can see the joy of them when it's like, you know, a Chinese translation. They're like over excited, over thankful.
You said something very interesting at the talk. You spoke about Jewish identity and you said that it has grown historically through that sense of separateness, and that separateness has really worked for the Jewish identity because you've carried on your traditions and your different rituals. Based on the government's attack of this book, you must have some very conflictual or difficult questions to ask of your Jewish background.
I don't give the Ministry of Education the pleasure to to gain anything beyond all they had sucked out of this scandal, because they had too much interest, too much exploitation on my account, that I'm not going to give them the pleasure of having me having a question about my Judaism thanks to them. I go with my own debates without them causing me so much trouble. When I speak about my Jewishness as part of my DNA, I mean, Israel is very young. My Israeliness is based on my Jewishness heritage. So we are very much occupied in Israel by questioning, what are you more Israeli or more Jewish? Today I'm more Jewish or I'm more Israeli?
I suppose there's positives and negatives of all forms of nationalism, isn't there?
I don't get another pleasure I won't give the nationalists to take me to rethink of how much I appreciate nationhood. Mm-hmm. I do think that the sense of belonging to a place, being framed by borderlines, by official nation, having an idea, passport in my bag, belong to a place, having a sense, having a flag, having an anthem, all these things that I wish for my neighbors in Palestine to have, to live in dignity, depends on a boundary that is the first condition for respect, for having your own territory, knowing that you have a place on earth that is related to you, related to your family, your parents, is going to be relating to your children. So I don't think that all these needs that are being accomplished or satisfied by nationhood should be undermined. It's being taken advantage by politicians who turn nationalistic emotion to give a bad reputation for this human, natural need.
Presumably, though, whether there's artists, sculptors, poets, whatever they are, there are people in Israel who are very troubled by this, because there are Israelis who support Palestinians and there are those who don't. So I imagine there are other artists asking themselves big questions of their art and what their job is as an artist to engage with public life in some way with their art.
You know what, I don't consider myself a radical. I am, and my work, my literary work is not radical. It's subtle. But if I can look of the past decade, these governments, they had radicalized empathy. And they had made this acknowledgement of the one on the other side, of those ones on the other sides, to be a radical act. If you empathize with the Palestinians in Israel nowadays, it's being considered unpatriotic thing to do. If you can understand their rational process, if you can humanize them by the fact that you humanize them, you've been considered to be turning your back to your own tribe's rationalizations. And this is something that we didn't have 20 years ago. It's only under the shape of the shadow of Netanyahu regime. His interest is to make empathy, human instincts, to be non-patriot. And I cannot be more judgmental towards it. I cannot be more critical. Me and my friends in art, our magic, and this is why witches maybe were haunted for creating magic, it's identification, going from your identity, living your identity, and traveling within someone else's skin, wearing someone else's gaze, tasting what it is to be someone else. This is the magic of identification. This is the miracle of literature, of art. So you cannot deny this from democratic citizens of Israeli state.
So, Doris, what is your hope with All the Rivers? It's created quite an international stir and has stimulated lots of different conversations on ideas related to nationalism, identity, and borders. So I'm just wondering, you started this out as an eulogy of sorts for a very close friend. What is your hope now?
Well, I think this book had traveled such a journey that I could never expect it to have. I wrote it as a letter of love, and it became to be suspected as a political manifest, and it came back to be a literary work, back to into 23 languages, and it travels the world, and it has more and more readership extended, and having more and more people to, I mean, it's the acoustic of the heart that we're engaged with in this job of writing novels. It's not crying out loud in squares and changing the world, and it's bit by bit. It's I hope for this book to reach the impact that the books I love and the books that influenced me and gave me the food of thought of that prolonged within my mind. I wish for the book to gain this achievement in the scale of one person. I leave it there. I know that it's such a huge mileage within time, within people's thinking, with perspectives. I consider it to be a huge step.
Thank you.
And that was Israeli novelist, screenwriter and poet Dorit Rabinian, who gave a wonderful reading from All the Rivers at this year's International Literature Festival Dublin. All the Rivers is published by Profile Books and retails for just under €13 in paperback. I can also recommend two other of Dorit's publications, Persian Brides and Our Weddings.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. To understand the future, writes British novelist and journalist Matt Haig, you must understand the past. We forget some of our future, just as we forget some of our past. Well, earlier in the week, I had the very great pleasure of talking with Matt on the publication of his 14th book, How to Stop Time.
Hi, my name's Matt Haig. I'm a writer. I've written lots and lots of books. I've mainly write novels for adults. I've written some children's books as well. I wrote a kind of memoir about myself as well called Reasons to Stay Alive. But my latest book is a novel. It's How to Stop Time. It's about a 400-year-old man, basically, who looks perfectly ordinary, 40-year-old, history teacher, but he himself is history, and it's his story of how to love and how to live if everything you've ever known you've lost at some point. And I'm going to read you a little extract now. This is a fair bit into the story. This is page 194. So this is in London. He's been all around the world doing various things, and this is the narrator, Tom Hazard, in London, contemplating life and love, and he's just fallen in love with this a fellow teacher called Camille. It is strange how close the past is, even when you imagine it to be so far away. Strange how it can just jump out of a sentence and hit you. Strange how every object or word can house a ghost. The past is not one separate place. It is many, many places, and they are always ready to rise into the present. One minute, it is the 1590s. The next, it is the 1920s. And it is all related. It is all the accumulation of time. It builds up and builds up and can catch you violently off guard at any moment. The past resides inside the present, repeating, hiccuping, reminding you of all the stuff that no longer is. It bleeds out from road signs and plaques on park benches and songs and surnames and faces and the covers of books. Sometimes just the sight of a tree or a sunset can smack you with the power of every tree or sunset you have ever seen, and there is no way to protect yourself. There is no possible way of living in a world without books or trees or sunsets. There just isn't. Are you okay? Camille asks me, her hand resting on the cover of her book, so only the word tender is visible. Yes, I'm still getting these headaches, though. Have you been to the doctor? No, but I will. Going to the doctor, of course, is the last thing I am going to do. I look at her. She has the kind of face that makes you want to speak, to tell things to. It is a dangerous face. Maybe you need some more sleep, she says. I wonder what she means, and she can see me wondering, because then she says, I saw on Facebook that you liked my post at 3 a.m. That's an interesting time for you to be awake on a school night. Oh, there is a sliver of mischief in her smile.
Really well done on the book, Matt. I have to say it's a very engaged read, very poetic and romantic in parts. I really liked it. As I was going through the book, it struck me that possibly none of us really understand time, that we haven't fully grasped or had a proper insight on time. Like, we have time zones, we have clocks, we can chart distances, but we don't really get it, do we?
No, I don't think so. But I think the bigger thing is we don't really get our lives and our existence in a way. And time is the thing which is sort of against us, because we only have a short span on Earth, and we're all sort of still hobbling about in the dark, I think, really. But that's not to say that we can't know certain things, and maybe we can't work out a bit about ourselves as individuals. But I think time's fascinating, and I think there's certain points in life where you feel it more than others. I think as a child, time is a sort of infinite concept, you know.
How would you describe how to stop time? Because I think if you brought this book to any book club, for example, some people would look at it as a reflection on grief and trauma. Others would see it as a romantic novel. And others would see some of the deep questions that you're asking. So I'm wondering, when we're meeting people and introducing the book, how are you describing it? Because it could mean so much to so many different types of personalities, I suppose.
Yeah. I'm really bad at sort of distilling books into sentences. I think with How to Stop Time, it would be wrong to go into How to Stop Time thinking it just as, say, a love story, even though it has got love in it. And it'd equally be wrong to see it as some sort of fantasy epic about time or a contemporary, you know. So I'm a bit greedy, basically, when I write. I just try and shoehorn in everything I want to put in. So I ignore genre. I forget what I'm meant to be writing or what publishers want me to write, and just write exactly, you know, the book I want to write. So in a way, it's all those things you just said, but it's not one specific thing.
Well, what were the big questions that you were asking yourself?
Well, I don't know. I think the reason I wrote this book was the idea of having someone who's outside ourselves, who is in human life, but he's somehow different, and he's lived a lot longer, so he's got that experience. I'm always drawn to outsiders, full stop. And I think, well, I'm pretty sure I know that comes from my own experience when I was younger, being ill with invisible things like depression and anxiety, and feeling very outside, as a lot of people do. And so there's a slight, even though it's totally fantasy, there's a slight autobiographical element to that outsider feeling. But yeah, I it was also just fun. It was fun to just have a sort of fantasy time machine, even though it's not time travel in that sense. But for me to be able to go back to my favourite periods and just, you know, bump into F. Scott Fitzgerald in a bar in Paris was an indulgent, pleasurable thing to do. And when you've written quite a few books down the line, you need constantly to find new ways to keep it fun.
Yeah, it was very interesting flipping through the centuries and bumping into Mr. Shakespeare and other great figures. You reference a lot of interesting philosophers, and one of them is the great German philosopher Schopenhauer. And he's such a wealth of questions that man has asked. It's quite something. But it really got me thinking. You quote Schopenhauer: "Every man takes the limits of his own field of vision as the limits of the world." Do you agree with that?
Not necessarily, but I agree that we all have our competing perspectives. So I find Schopenhauer interesting. He was a completely miserable guy. He was like really morbidly miserable. Yeah, he had the answers to so many things, but you wouldn't want to sort of emulate Schopenhauer's approach to life or living, because he was a sort of miserly figure, very brilliant figure, but he didn't seem to have much joy in his existence. But yeah, I kind of agree that we all have different perspectives, and I feel it much more nowadays in the internet age and social media age, that we all bring our own visions, which aren't necessarily right or wrong, but they're creating more and more friction as they rub up against each other.
Tom, our narrator, is having difficulties living in the present, and every 8 years he has to assume a new identity. And within all of that, there's lots of restrictions on what he can do, whether he can fall in love or have proper intimacy. And in a lot of ways, he's living in the past, And sometimes he's living in the future, or he's living for, in some ways, maybe the next step. Is that something that you really wanted to unpack, or did you just want to put that out to the reader? Maybe how we're all living today and whether we're really present or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very hard to live in the present. And I notice it as a father, where you feel time because your children are growing up so fast, and not just in life generally, and you just want to hold on to those good moments and preserve them and to actually exist in the present. And I'm terrible for sort of imagining future scenarios or missing things in the past. And so I think as a species, we find it fundamentally quite difficult to have that gift of living in the moment. And obviously, there is no technical scientific way of stopping time, but I think there is a way of experiencing a time which is better than we normally experience it by truly forgetting the worries and the baggage that we carry from the past and from thinking about the future, and just sort of being our animal selves and just appreciating life itself, rather than constantly worrying about money and jobs and relationships and everything else we do about the future, but just think of this present and finding a way to live inside that present.
Throughout the novel, Tom wrestles with the fact that he can't let go of his past and his love for his wife and his daughter. And that he says a couple of times that, you know, the past is never gone. It's only hiding to some degree.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a great, is it Auden quote about how we do not all inhabit the same time. And it's something that I always think about, how we live amongst each other, but we're all products of different times, and you know, the buildings we walk past are the most visible example of that. But we're all, you know, we're not just in 2017. There's so many things that are still around, and so many echoes in every day, whether it's literal echoes like in songs and books that we read. But yeah, I'm fascinated by the way time weaves together, because yeah, I think it's important, although we've got to live in the present, is to do that. I think it helps to have respect for history and to see our place, not just in space, but in time. And it's quite liberating.
Yeah, that's interesting, because throughout the book, within all the cultural patterning of the different centuries, we get a lot of prejudice, we get a lot of alienation, we get people making judgments on other people, and you get a lot of poverty within that. And it does make you think about how we're evolving and, you know, some degree of human progress.
Yes. Well, I think we are, you know, I do believe in progress, but I think we sometimes always feel like the present is the end point of progress. Whereas, you know, in 500 years, this might be seen as another dark ages. We don't know, do we? We don't know what's going to come. But I think it's, we're not used to seeing ourselves as part of history. We always see history as another place, but we're continually making history. You know, that's what the present is. History itself, when Shakespeare was alive, he wasn't thinking of himself as a historical figure. He was just being a human being called William Shakespeare. So I find that sometimes we're sort of, however much we know the past, we're blinded to it as a former present, and we just see it as this other place. And it was just fun to see it as real, to see sort of Shakespeare in a pub, possibly having a smoke, you know, because tobacco was a new thing, and just being a real human being. That was one of the fun bits to write.
The longer you live, the more you realise that nothing is fixed. Everyone will become a refugee if they live long enough. Everyone would realise their nationality means little in the long run. Everyone would see their worldviews challenged and disproved. Everyone would realise that the thing that defines a human being is being a human. They're very politically charged words, Matt, and they resonate so deeply within how we're looking at all the problems with migration and refugees and trafficking of people. Was that something that was important for you to bring out in the novel?
Yeah, well, I was writing it all through all the Brexit campaign and things like that. So there was that sort of atmosphere going on in my country and in England. And it was kind of nauseating, the whole campaign, really. And it's not just Britain. I mean, the world, you know, with the rise of various kinds of right-wing nationalism and, concerns about immigration and all this stuff. And I just think we risk losing our sort of common core as human beings and placing other things and flags and nationalities above that. And we've always risked that. But we haven't progressed. And it's frustrating that when we seem to be taking a couple of steps back a few decades. In some ways it's my most political novel, I suppose.
Can I ask you about music? There's a real musical quality to this novel. And Tom, our narrator, plays multiple instruments. And it's one aspect of his identity that he carries through history. And at one stage, he says something to Rose, his great love, that music is about time. It's about controlling time. I thought that was really interesting. I know you said to me that you write lyrics as well for...
Yeah, well, I've just started to write some songs. I was asked to. It was one of the nicest things that's ever... come my way, a musician called Andy Burrows, who used to be in the band Razorlight, and he writes songs for Tom Adele, and he's written the songs for the Ricky Gervais spoof band and stuff. And he likes my work, and he said, ever fancied writing some songs? So I was starting to write these songs, and it was just so liberating, because songs are shorter than novels, so that was quite good. And I genuinely think, and this is going to sound quite pretentious, but I think there is a music contained in words, a silent music that you hear. And I think writers that I like and books that I like have a clear musicality to them. So I'm not a musician. One of my biggest regrets in life is that I didn't continue with the piano, because I became a teenager, and then it wasn't the done thing for boys in a state school in England to be playing the piano. So I stopped playing the piano. But I think books can be a kind of music.
And there's a tempo to words which can, from a reader's perspective, resonate in lots of different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. When you read it, you're picking up that music, definitely.
I was reading an interview that you gave to The Guardian recently, and you said something that I found really interesting. And it also is quite troubling, but very, very interesting. You said to be calm becomes a kind of revolutionary act. I thought that was very powerful words. But it doesn't, I suppose, reflect too well on how we are evolving as a society.
No. I think what I mean by that is two things. One, in a very literal, basic sense, when you've got anxiety, and I've had an anxiety disorder before, and I live with anxiety quite a lot, you actually have to get used to rebelling against your own mind in some ways, because you have this constant chatter in your head and worries about nothing, and you have to just learn to ignore it and carry on regardless and sort of stick your fingers up at it and just forget about it. And in a bigger way, I think society is trying to make us slowly insane. And I don't think it's a conscious thing by any individual or there's any sinister conspiracy going on. I just think if you think about marketing, if you think about advertising, if we were happy with absolutely everything in our lives, that would be the worst thing possible for a marketer, because they want us to worry about aging, to sell us moisturizers and anti-aging creams. They want us to worry about status, so we've got a better car than our neighbors or whatever, or keeping up with our neighbors. And they, you know, it's constant trying to make us a little bit more neurotic so we can buy the solution to these problems that we're given and thrust upon us. And I think to be calm and to ignore all that does feel revolutionary, in the sense that, you know, you're resisting a lot of the messages that are being put forward about what we should look like. Beach body, you know, all that stuff.
Does the method, the discipline and the practice of writing help you in any way, though, to deal with some of those challenges?
Yeah, I need to write. I never had a sort of childhood ambition to be a writer, or a teenage ambition. It came directly with me out of being ill and anxious and stuff like that. And since then, it's been... I'm not a overtly religious person. I'm not overtly spiritual, but it's been my sort of meditation. It's been a way of, I think it is what that spiritual side is for a lot of people, where it's a way of finding out about myself. It's a way of exploring things. And I've got to know myself through writing.
That was British writer and journalist Matt Haig. How to Stop Time is published by Canongate and is available in all good bookshops for just under €18 in hardback. Now, I have to say hats off to Matt. How to Stop Time is an unbelievably gentle and moving meditation on the nature of grief, memory and love. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Brunock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end this evening's broadcast with the emotive words of Matt Haig from How to Stop Time. As just as it takes a moment to die, it only takes a moment to live. You just close your eyes and let every futile fear slip away. And then in this new state, free from fear, you ask yourself, who am I? If I could live without doubt, what would I do? If I could be kind without the fear of being fucked over? I could love without fear of being hurt. If I could taste the sweetness of today without thinking of how I will miss that taste tomorrow? If I could not fear the passing of time and the people it will steal? Yes, what would I do? What would I care for? What battle would I fight? Which paths would I step down? What joys would I allow myself? What internal mysteries would I solve? How, in short, would I live? Stirring words indeed. Good night.